Hello, everyone, and welcome to a brand new episode of the Jams and D Podcast Record Club, where each week one of us picks an album for everyone else to listen to, review it, and then we do. And this week, we're going to be talking about Riley's recommended album, which is Sunny Day Real Estate's How It Feels to Be Something On. Riley, who are Sunny Day Real Estate, and why are we talking about their esteemed third album?
Okay, so on the off chance that anyone who's watching doesn't know who Sunny Day Real Estate is, I'm sure everyone does. They are an American rock band from Seattle, came to prominence in the early 90s with one of the most seminal records in the history of emo music, that being 1994's Diary. Diary's about as influential as any record can be within a particular genre, right? Like basically all of the emo that we talk about in some form or fashion owes a lot to this record, but more broadly to Sunny Day Real Estate as a band as well, because they're a lot more complex and their progression is a lot more unusual than you might expect if Diary is the only thing that you've heard from them. And Diary is, it's a great record. It's a classic for a good measure. It is basically, the Loveless of emo. And it consumes so much of the conversation around this band for understandable reasons. But there's a lot more to Sunny Day Real Estate than just Diary. And in fact, it didn't take them very long to move away from that more aggressive, hardcore influenced sound into spaces that were just generally a lot more contemplative, a lot more measured, a lot more indebted to alt-rock and a more varied set of influences. And then ultimately, in the final stretch of their run, embracing elements of progressive music as well. Sunny Day Real Estate are a fascinating band, and I think underappreciated for the breadth of what they were able to achieve within such a limited amount of releases and amongst so much turmoil as well. It's one of the cliches about Sunny Day Real Estate is that they've broken up as many times as they've released albums. Their chemistry was the story of Sunny Day Real Estate as a band and the struggles that they often went through to be able to create a record. The clashes of personality that exists within that band are well told at this point. I'll start from the beginning just to kind of give a full story of how we get to this album, because there's a lot of stuff that happens between Sunny Day Real Estate coming into being and the album we're going to talk about today existing as well. The band formed in 1992 when guitarist Dan Horner and bassist Nate Mendel met drummer William Goldsmith, and the three of them decided to form a band together. Again, have to emphasize how we're situated within the Seattle grunge scene here in 1992, a very loaded point in musical history as well, where a lot of, creative energy is being sparked. And they decided they wanted to form a band, but they needed a vocalist. And after a while, and after going through a few early iterations, including one period where they were famously called Chewbacca Kaboom, they went through a series of name changes and eventually settled on Sunny Day Real Estate and recruited a singer, a high school friend of William Goldsmith, Jeremy Enig. And it's worth noting that Jeremy was considerably younger than the other members of Sunny Day Real Estate. And that, in combination with him being the last member to join, means that you can kind of see how the last member to join, the youngest member of the band, quickly becoming the front man and essentially kind of core personality of the band would create some tensions as well. And the energy that they had together and that particular very memorable, very abrasive style of performance that Jeremy had early on. If you've heard Diary, you'll know that whining, just strained, gnarly sound that he channels vocally on that album. One of the things that's most striking about the record, and something that, I've heard that record dozens of times, I never stop thinking whenever I listen to it, that is not healthy, what this poor boy is doing to his voice. You should not do that to your voice. It's not sustainable. And evidently, Jeremy realized that as well, as it wouldn't take very long for the band stylistically and musically, and Jeremy as a performer, to kind of evolve away from that raw, aggressive template into something a little bit more multifaceted. However, that would happen in tandem with the band kind of falling apart. Their second record, 1995 self-titled album, was produced amidst a complete internal collapse of the band. It is technically an unfinished album. They were not able to finish the record before breaking up, basically, to the point where they weren't even able to decide on artwork or a title for the album, hence why it appears the way that it is, why it's as short as it is, why it's as bizarrely structured as it is as well, to the point where a good chunk of the songs on LP2 don't even have finished lyrics. In fact, if you pay close attention to the lyrics on this album, a lot of them are actually placeholder gibberish. It's a really fraught album, basically, and unfortunately for Sunny Day Real Estate, because Diary was so successful, it was a really successful album, that falling apart and the trouble that they had with their second album really basically punched a hole in their momentum as a band. They broke up, and Jeremy released a solo album, a really underrated record, actually, that I want to shout out, called Return of the Frog Queen, that if you listen to that album and you compare it to those early Sunny Day Real Estate records, it's almost unrecognizable the direction that he's gone in. It's much more indie rock, but it takes from these sort of swirling 80s chamber pop and art pop influences as well. It's a really unique album that I highly recommend. And if you want to get to the heart of how Sunny Day Real Estate turned from the band that produced those first two albums to the band that produced How It Feels to Be Something On and The Rising Tide, Return of the Frog Queen is kind of the missing link. But basically, the band fell apart, and a big part of what was the cause of this was Jeremy's sudden conversion to Christianity, or I guess a kind of realization of his Christianity that changed his outlook dramatically, that affected the way he viewed not only the world and his own life, but his artistic process as well, and created some dissonance within the band too, that puts various members sort of at odds with each other as well. The most notable being that there was a fallout involving bassist Nate Mendel, who took a break from the band and joined up with Dave Grohl and the Foo Fighters. And ultimately, if you know anything about the Foo Fighters, you'll know that Nate Mendel essentially decided to stay with them. William Goldsmith, I think, as well, also played on Color and the Shape too. So there was a weird period there where this band, where Sunny Day Real Estate had kind of evaporated, and half of its constituency could potentially just be the Foo Fighters. But that didn't really stick apart from Mendel, although we will get back to Mendel's absence from this album later on as well, because it is touched on thematically in one of the songs on this record, which we'll get to. But the band ultimately did nevertheless come back together and produce this album, How It Feels to Be Something On, which came out in September of 1998. And part of the reason why I chose it for Record Club this month is that this is the month in which this record turns 25. And going back to it as a SDRE fan who spent a lot more time when I was younger listening to Diary than this, I was vividly struck by how much I connected with this album, so much more than I did when I was younger. When I was younger, I kind of thought, well, this is the more alt-rock leaning, eerie album, basically, in my mind, that I had filed it away as, that I thought was really, really cool and had some great songs on it, but that never really spoke to me on the level of Diary. And I think a lot of people who come into Sunny Day Real Estate through Diary, or who approach them as this kind of pivotal band in the history of emo, end up being a little bit distanced from their later records, because, you know, if you view them as the Diary band, and if you only go to them when you're in the mood for this really aggressive, hardcore tinged emo, you're not going to necessarily get that from their later stuff. And so it may feel a little bit like a different band, or something that you're at the least kind of unsure of how to approach. I think I've seen that a little bit with people with this album in the past as well. And I kind of count myself in that group a little bit too. I like this album. I've always liked this album, but it's never been one that I've spent a lot of time with until recently, until I went back to it on its 25th birthday, and the fucking thing just sang to me from the fucking skies. Everything clicked into place, and suddenly, not only did I have a renewed appreciation for this album, it overtook Diary and is now my favorite Sunny Day Real Estate album. And I know that you two also feel fairly positively about this record as well. Jake, I know that as often happens with you and I, we kind of, sometimes we have phases with an album, like together, where we both kind of fall in love with something and it's sort of, it's all we can talk about for a little while. And this has kind of ended up being one of those things as well. So why don't we kind of reserve our enthusiasm a little bit and throw to Morgan first. You obviously share a lot of the same musical loves as we do in terms of 90s rock music and emo as well. What's your relationship with SDRE been like to the extent that you have one? And what are your overall thoughts on this particular record?
I heard Diary for the first time probably 8 or 9 years ago now. And I haven't listened to it in probably 5 or 6. So my memory is a little fuzzy on it. It's just been too long and a sort of an old infatuation that I haven't really caught up with, except for the first 3 songs on that album, which are sort of like 3/4 of the emo Mount Rushmore. And yep. They have like a Jimmy Eat World song on the 4th end of that. I can't remember the exact moment I heard 7 for the first time, but I was not the same person after, even now that I've listened to this album and fallen completely madly head over heels in love with it. I'm not sure there's any song of theirs that I've heard that surpasses 7. The point is, I was one of those people who, you know, that heard Diary and never really thought too much about looking into the remainder of this band's discography. And clearly that was a mistake, because this How It Feels to Be Something On is, especially knowing what I know now about LP2, this feels like the sort of sophomore effort that they never really got to make. And in so many ways, it's sort of the quieter, more stark, more atmospheric inversion of so much of what was happening on Diary. And so much of it is so smart and well thought out and well constructed, but it never once loses the emotionality of Diary. It may not be as sort of raw and aggressive, and I really would have to go back and give Diary a full listen to say one way or the other if I prefer this or that record. But it's so much of that, the emotionality of it remains intact, even if this is a less straightforward and more challenging record in some ways. Every aspect of it being challenging pays off so much in the long run. It is unfortunate that any record this band makes is in the position of living in Diary shadow. So it's an amazing, deeply rewarding record nonetheless.
It's had a bit of a reclamation over the years, I'd say, along with later albums from bands like Fugazi and Unwound, who are very different bands, to be fair, but they both kind of have similar arcs of their earlier music being, you know, quite seminal and, you know, well-acclaimed classics of hardcore, punk adjacent, you know, grimy, dirty shit. And then their later records being a little bit more ambitious and mature, quote unquote, and sophisticated in their compositional style, such that they get more acclaim and interest more towards the internet age, where they become a little bit more accessible and where, I guess, audiences have a little bit more time to kind of soak those in, as well as their comparative, you know, lack of acclaim being intriguing in a huge way. And I think How It Feels to Be Something On has benefited from that as well. It's a record that wasn't really poorly received when it came out. It's just that I think the world had in large part kind of moved on from Sunny Day Real Estate as well. There was this fixed idea of who they were. And then when, you know, Mendel and Goldsmith got involved in Foo Fighters as well, that kind of only reinforced this stereotypical idea of Sunny Day Real Estate as this kind of rock band in the 90s sense. And so as their actual records as a band moved away from what was fashionable, it's sort of meant that they've languished a bit until more recently, where they've been reacclaimed and kind of remembered more positively. Jake, what's your take on this particular record and the weird arc that this band has had getting to this point as well?
I think a lot of the response or even like lack thereof for the albums, just like in terms of their arc, is just kind of like, again, it's like a ton of cosmic coincidences that just kind of happen to coincide. And I think a lot of it too is that like then something that reinforces your take of just like the world moving past this band is that Diary came out in 1994, otherwise known as the year that grunge basically was formally killed by the death of Kurt Cobain.
And the release of Korn's self-titled.
Regardless, I feel like this informs the change in sound even more. And basically, like when I approached this band, which is funny because like, again, cosmic coincidence here is that you were listening to this album, which is what prompted me to join you. But I planned on listening to this band this very same week. I had downloaded all four of these albums and I was planning on doing it. And then I saw you were doing it. And I was like, well, then I just might as well. I'll fucking listen to Diary, and I listened to the discography in order. I got to approach each of these albums as like really individual statements, and so view them from fresh eyes. That's the wonderful thing that Riley was talking about, is that like in the internet age, you can kind of just see things for what they are. You're unclouded by the initial like buzz or lack thereof of some albums, and the continuity of a discography can mean something entirely different to you. So I got to approach Diary and listen to it, and as somebody who loves grunge and emo, this album fucking rules. I think that this is every bit as great as people say that it is. And then so immediately after that, it's like they wasted no time, and I'm sure that a lot of it has to do with the fact that, again, it was a very fraught time for them creatively. The album is technically unfinished, but LP2 is an album I find fascinating, just like viewing it in a vacuum, or just viewing it and compared to like what it's sandwiched between, because it is very clearly a transitional step in a particular direction. And I love LP2, for the record, as much as someone can love something that's like, again, borderline unfinished, but like it's got so many sonic ideas that I get along with. There's a weirder, wirier, kind of like mathier influence on there. There's almost like a post-punky vibe to some of those songs. What kills it for me is kind of the sequencing and the fact that it's very much an album that is structurally like very, very obviously unsound. But still, I really love all the individual songs, but it made me like, once I listened to that, I was like, I hope that in the next album, they take a lot of these ideas and they actually refine them into something that just fits into a greater whole a lot better. And that's basically exactly what they do on here, except they do it in a way that feels like each of those improvements and those directions that they wanted to go in is less like a general gesture and more something that feels fully solidified, fully compact, because the sound here is like, I can talk about lots of different like influences of genre and bands on here, and I still cannot quite find a one-to-one comparison to what it feels like to listen to this album. It's a very, very strange coalescence of very different ideas and very different sounds and very different approaches. And again, none of it is all that immediate. Unless you're looking for something that's weird, that's atmospheric, that's gloomier, that kind of revels in itself a little bit more. Again, from the moment the first song on this album ends, I was like, oh, holy shit. We've got something great here, because I listened to all four Sunny Day Real Estate albums multiple times in this like little, week and a half long period, because I've, hyperfixations be like. And this is the one that I've gone back to the most, just by virtue of the fact that it's the one that's intrigued me the most. And of all of their songs, I would say that the opening track on here, Pillars, is, albeit narrowly, because they have many perfect songs, honestly, I would say that Pillars is my favorite. It starts off again with this like kind of mathy riff, and it's slow, it's contemplative, it's moody. And what really stands out to me about this track is the writing style. Diary is, it's more than just a template for emo in terms of like sound in a lot of respects, but it is that way in terms of attitude and in terms of writing and what it is talking about and like its preoccupations. It's the quintessential emo album for a reason. Take like a song like In Circles, from Diary, for example. Like, this is written to be the most anthemic version of itself. It is like this perfectly distilled essence of emo in a universal sense. Whereas here, Pillars opens with the passage of, "But you were always one to stay the same, girl. I know you want to be the rain, and I know that we would fall in there for a time and then unfall again." Like, this idea of something like happening and then unspooling. Like, there's this continuous idea on this album, lyrically speaking, of things being one way and then being like deconstructed, like creation and destruction. There's this poeticism and flow to these ideas on here that's so natural that it almost obfuscates how strange the song feels and how disquieting it is overall. And it just makes me go back to it over and over. And I feel like when I listen to this song, like, I don't listen to it, I explore it. Like, there's just so much of this album that feels deep and dark and unknowable, and I love that about it.
I think a good way of approaching this record and kind of interrogating what it's doing and what Jeremy's doing and why the album works is to think about it in the context of the time it came out. And we're talking about the late 90s, we're talking about the Clinton era, we're talking about a particular time where concerns of consumerism and concerns of shallow living were becoming kind of more and more popular to talk about in kind of countercultural art, because so much of popular cultural art was about hedonism, was about living through vice, was about a kind of shallowness that writers like Jeremy are kind of reacting against. It's worth noting as well that it's not just Jeremy who writes and performs on this record in a vocal capacity as well. Dan Horner contributes pretty heavily. In fact, he wrote the lyrics for the song 100 Million. And they both, I think, share a perspective of cynicism towards the way that commercialism and consumerism has kind of sucked American pop culture into a space of vapidity, basically. And this was a pretty common, you know, place to offer commentary from in alternative music in the late 90s and alternative culture in the late 90s as well. It was very commonplace. What's different about this is Jeremy's particular perspective as well, the place where he comes from, being someone who has at this point in time a really close relationship with God and with spirituality as well, and so there's this cynicism about American culture and consumerism that comes through in songs like Pillars and songs like 100 Million and songs like The Prophet and Roses and Water. But there's also this sense of trying to escape it by communing with the divine, Greater. Basically. Every Shining Time You Arrive is essentially, you know, a song about Jeremy's relationship with God. And so the record is even more in a strange and unusual position because of that particular philosophy and because of that particular perspective. I mean, it's most vividly obvious in a song like The Prophet, which has this kind of really heavy Eastern influence and this really unusual, progressive, moody structure to it across its 5-minute runtime as well. But really, that's kind of the most obvious example of something you see across the entire record, and particularly in a song like Pillars as well, which is just so eerie and swirling in its tone. You get alternatively very blunt lyricism about these ideas in songs like 100 Million. It's kind of hard not to see what that song is about. It's very straight faced. But then you also get songs that are like almost completely inscrutable. Like, no matter how many times I read the lyrics and try to interpret, I have no idea what the title track is about at all. It's just complete gobbledygook as far as I'm concerned.
All I know is I felt that shit, man.
But so much of the appeal of the record comes not as much from its writing, but from the performance that Jeremy offers on this record as well. It's this kind of, you know, he's leaned more into this nasal space, and I compared him a little bit to Dan Behar of Destroyer, but mixed with like Youth Lagoon. And I'm like, these are both references that are post Sunny Day Real Estate, so they're not that great. But there's also a little bit of like Billy Corgan in there as well. I think the spirit of Smashing Pumpkins is alive and well in this iteration of the band. And so that particular quality in the performance vocally, in combination with some musical compositions that are quite unusual as well, like Roses and Water.
It's in how the a lot of the guitar tones on here are bright. A lot of them are sour. They are bent. They are very strange. Like, this album to me sounds like something that once was legible and maybe even beautiful, and then feels like perverted, or just like, again, something that was taken and changed and fundamentally altered. You get the sense that something about it feels almost like corrupted. But it's not all just like complete musical sort of esotericism, which, like, don't get me wrong, is a lot of the appeal of why this is a great record musically. But there are still moments of like genuine meat and potatoes, just like great satisfying musicianship on here. Like, again, that title track at the very end of the sort of the riffs at the end of here sound, again, exactly like the ones on the title track of Jeff Buckley's Grace. Something that I know that Riley and I, we were just like, ah, light bulb moment, holy yeah. shit.
When you mentioned that, it really clicked something into place for me as well about the particular time and space that record and this one occupy. You know, it's this slightly slanted thing where it takes from alt rock and it takes from a lot of the aesthetics of what was going on at the moment, but the perspective of the writer, the singer, and the, I guess, content of the songs is so at odds with that and so different to what you would expect from that it just feels so unique and alluring, because you don't expect to hear an album that sounds like this with a singer doing what Jeremy does, and you don't expect necessarily an album that sounds like some of the more raucous moments of Grace to be complemented by the insane dexterity and emotional nuance of Jeff either. So it's a really alluring thing when your expectations can be upended in such surprising and interesting ways as these records do. And like, I want to shout out the song Guitar and Video Games as well, which is another kind of Sunny Day Real Estate standard too, where it's one of the moments on the record where Jeremy most sort of boldly confronts, you know, in a meta sense, what the band are doing. You know, what if we refuse to follow the rules of fashion? Exploring the weird space that he exists in. And again, his relationship to the core emotional tenets of the place where he came from, of the earlier music that he made, the rawness, the immaturity of the place that he was at when he wrote an album like Diary. You know, remember you in the top of my room, all these things remade me and caused me to be something grand. Two Promises as well is a song where Jeremy, it feels like Jeremy is kind of directly confronting some of the cliches or stereotypes or typical manifestations of, you know, the emo personality or the male emo songwriter as well. You know, it's a song about being heartbroken, but specifically it's a song about examining someone who is heartbroken. You know, all of the way the lyrics are structured are like third person commenting on some male figure who is, you know, dwelling on his heartbreak and essentially allowing himself to kind of be subsumed by negativity, you know, shutting himself away, being this reclusive, hate-filled, bitter person. And the way that, you know, just a few years previously, Jeremy would have written the song in the first person. He would have written the song about that experience, about what that feels like. But now the framing of it means that you're immediately presented with this distance from it. It becomes a commentary on a song that would be on Diary. And so it becomes a commentary on emo and on, you know, earlier Sunny Day Real Estate. So that's a really interesting way that Jeremy seems to like purposefully distance himself from not only his previous music, but just the whole like ideology and philosophy and aesthetic and personality that came from. You know, that's one of the things that makes Sunny Day Real Estate's arc so fascinating to me, is that you get a picture of someone who very quickly reacts against not just the style of music that made them famous, but the kind of person they were in that space, you know, the kind of life that they led and the whole philosophy of that genre as well. One of the interesting things about emo history as well is like there's so many different waves and revivals because there's only so long that emo can be in the popular consciousness before people just get embarrassed by it and people reject it. And that's the same with any kind of movement that has its own sort of personalized philosophy, where after a while you just want to react against it. And that's something that's happened in pop culture a lot with the way that emo and pop punk have been present and then absent and then present again in various pop cultural trends. You know, emo is fascinating, and emo has a loaded history and a troubled history, and a lot of it again is rooted in the fact that this is music that manifests and talks frankly and honestly and sometimes, you know, not prettily about, you know, pretty unhealthy states of being and pretty unhealthy, you know, ways of thinking about life and the world. And so Sunny Day Real Estate to me were one of the first bands, obviously one of the first emo bands, but equally one of the first bands to really react against emo as well. And to say, you know, to put, you know, distance between what they had, this earlier iteration of them that came to be so popular. And that's something that makes how it feels to be something on not only feel like fascinating on a kind of meta level, but also like it's a record that I think I've come to appreciate more as I've gotten older and as I've gotten, you know, more distance from the kind of person I was when Diary was my whole life as well. Though I don't have the perspective of, you know, born again Christianity that Jeremy works from in this space, I do have this, you know, increased distance from that earlier style of music. And it's not that I don't relate to it anymore. It's not that I don't find emotional connection in it, but just that I view it more abstractly. And that seems to be the place that Jeremy is operating from with basically all of this record as well. I don't know what it means to be something on, but maybe it means to be like the only interpretation I have is that it means to be really rocked up, like riled up, like emotionally intense, like just full of some kind of thing that you need to get out. And to me, a lot of the identity of this record is reckoning with like how that feels, how it feels to have some, you know, deep-seated intensity within you that you need to get out, and what it's like to express that and your relationship with those feelings as you get older, and as what those feelings are change. I'm getting really abstract here, as I typically do, but that's, I think, the core of what the album is. It's like what honest expression means when you're so defined by an immaturity and a really kind of vulnerable, ugly stage of your life that comes to be your whole personality in the view of the public, right? Because Jeremy was like 18 or 19 when he wrote and recorded Diary, right? He was operating from such a young perspective and being thrown into the limelight so dramatically again. All this is to say, like, there's just more adultness in this album, right? There's more self-awareness of the tropes that you're working with and that you're playing around with. And, you know, with that adultness comes more versatility and variety in music as well. There's so many different songs that make, like, there's so many different sounds on this record. There's so many different visions of what Sunny Day Real Estate can be, whether it's the intensely brooding post-punk of Pillars or the radiant, shining major chord alt rock of Every Shining Time You Arrive, or the, you know, Eastern tinged genre fusion of The Prophet, or whatever you want to highlight. Days Were Golden's even kind of slowcore-y in a very 90s sort of Red House Painters low-esque way. There's just so much possibility within this record, and it's so much of that sense of possibility comes from rejecting the constraints of genre and just embracing an internal, like, artistic drive that comes from a connection with something greater, I suppose. And that's what the album is to me.
I love when we listen to albums and we don't, like, particularly commune on what our interpretation of them necessarily is, and then we do an episode like this, and then two of us separately find out that we've basically come to the exact same conclusion, especially when something is this esoteric, because that was kind of the framing under which I discovered the sort of emotionality of this album, is specifically in reference to how it contrasts against Diary. And to me, this is an album that's full of anxieties and neuroses and sounds and ideas that are, again, natural sort of perversions and things that feel wrong, and again, explorations of moodiness. And basically it's kind of like what you said, the title is how it feels to be something on. And to me, how I interpret that is on is just aware. It's when you get older and then you look back on the things that you've made as like an artist, or you know, as a musician or whatever, and you look back as a more aware person and you're just like, God fuck, I hate the older that version of myself. They fucking suck. And then this entire album is basically a rebuttal of all of the ideas, all of the concepts that you find in Diary, the mentality of being this very preoccupied, self-concerned, very, you know, selfish, emotional teenager, because everybody's a selfish, emotional teenager. Like, it's not like a very, like, it's not like a specific indictment of him. It's just the idea of growing up and being that kind of inward looking person. And then you get older and then you're just like, God, I was such a fucking idiot. And then this album is basically talking about that same idea, but from the perspective of somebody who's grown from it. And then it allows this context to be like, it's the same, it's not necessarily like a sequel to Diary, it's a remake, it's a recontextualization, it's doing the same, like, it's doing something more interesting with the same parts, essentially. And it's doing it in a way that feels, I mean, again, it's of course it's more geared towards us. We find it more fascinating just because, again, we're older now, we've grown past the point where something, you know, the immediacy and the kind of the tightness of Diary is something we can still appreciate, but like, this is more enticing, this is more relatable. It's just, it's where we are right now. And especially, God, especially as somebody, like, if you're a creator, if you're a writer of any kind, I cannot recommend this fucking album enough. Because for as often as this album will occasionally burrow into itself and just like, you'll have to find your own meaning, or like meanings you will like look up will be completely separate from one another, overridingly, you do sort of get the idea of just like somebody who is so preoccupied and concerned with their work and how it evolves. And if you're somebody who has gone through, like, who has, you know, maintained a specific work of art over a period of time to the point where you start to feel very different about something, when, like, you know, if you have a band for a long period of time, it's the same thing. When you start that band, the albums that you make at the start of it, or, you know, you might not look back on those super fondly. You know, you start writing a book series, and then maybe you take a look at, you know, the ideas, the themes, the structures, the writing, whatever, and you view it in a certain way. And then that makes you innately, as a neurotic, you know, writer, you want to respond to that. You evolve, and then you eventually take something that both responds to and evolves from it. And that kind of dichotomy and, again, continuity is what makes these things so fucking interesting. That's a weird thing. We're talking about this band right after we talk about The World is a Beautiful Place, where we talk about how, you know, essential the idea of continuity is to that band. And it seems like emo bands in general, they're so occupied with this specific aspect of, like, you know, the idea of the human experience, of youth, of growth, and specifically contextualizing growth, that they all end up kind of being about this.
There's a wistfulness to this album. You know, it's not like, I don't think there's an outright, to me, it's not an outright hostility towards the past, but it's the sense of coming to terms with the inevitability of how you change over time. And I mean, time is the key, time's the 4-letter word, that this is all these bands and all these reference points, all these comparisons we've made all kind of come back to. It's about how you write about time as you age. And, you know, the record has this sort of wistful tone of reflection and putting to bed the past. You know, the most sort of obvious on the nose way that the past is tied together here, and for this purpose, is in Pillars you have the line, I walk in circles. You know, and back in, obviously, their massively famous emo standard in Circles, it's running down in circles. So you've gone from running in circles to walking.
Motherfucker loves circles.
you've gone from running in circles to walking in circles. And it's obviously a bit on the nose, but that's one way that the record kind of spells out to you how, what its whole attitude towards the past is going to be like. And there's some bittersweetness to it as well. In the song, The Shark's Own Private Fuck, which is specifically a song about, you know, Jeremy reckoning with losing Nate Mendel to Foo Fighters, essentially, and the band's fracturing, and that sense with which the promises that were made in the past or an idea of what the relationship was going to be like in that band, you know, fell apart. And he talks about, you know, you said you'd come back again, but you talk to yourself, believing the fear that drives your greed. When you discover the empty place, a hollow world of instant pleasures. I mean, it's fairly clear here that Jeremy has a pretty cynical view of Nate's decision to team up with Foo Fighters, that it's a cash grab, basically. You know, he has this very specific perspective that he operates from in this song. I mean, the refrain is, try to smile as they devour our youth, you know, a very sort of glib attitude towards commercial rock music, basically, and where Jeremy views it at that particular point in time. And then that bittersweetness is sort of surrendered or made peace with a little bit, at least in the closing song, Days Were Golden, which is one of my favorites on the record. It's beautifully languid and serene. Mm-hmm. And it comes from a place of having made peace with the past as well. I take your hopes. I promise you this, a dying cold world, but shimmering gold. Come, mama, now tell me the story, only laughing about our gilded wasteland, devoured, torn to pieces. Come now, we shine, small things ever calling out your name. You hear some other time, unchained, alive, a world undefined. A very poetic way of expressing a sentiment that's basically the place where we came from, whether it's the scene that we came from or the people that we were, is irrevocably changed. There's no place for that anymore. We don't belong there. We feel a distance from it, maybe even an alienation that's rooted in the reality of the music industry to a certain extent, or just where we are as people now. That means it is a gilded wasteland. You know, it's this rose-tinted glow around something that is in decay, basically. And we have to be aware of and acknowledge that decay and that change, but also allow for a world undefined, right? Some other time, some unforeseeable and unclear future that will nevertheless be hopefully really beautiful and full of possibility. And that's ultimately where the record ends, on that note of hope as well. You know, how it feels to be something on is kind of the ultimate, you know, anti-emo album in a certain sense, because it has emo DNA baked into it because of the roots of where these musicians have come from. And the fact that, you know, within a year of this, American Football would release their self-titled debut album, which would operate from a not dissimilar musical template to a lot of this album, but really focusing in on that technicality and musical minimalism to take emo in a completely new direction when paired with their style of writing. It's an ultimate anti-emo record in the sense that it's a fundamentally hopeful album, I think. Yeah, there's a lot of bitterness in it, particularly with the songs that talk about consumerism and pop culture and, you know, American values in the 90s, a very sort of hyper-capitalistic and self-indulgent time. But it has a sense of peace and distance and healthy perspective on all of those things that makes it a, you know, much more emotionally nuanced album, but also just an easier album for me to listen to, an easier album for me to just put on, because it's not racked with anxiety and difficult ugliness. It's just, there's all these different shades of the human experience when you're in your mid-20s, as we are, and you're a little bit more distanced from your angstiness and a little bit more measured and just a little bit more perspective, basically. And that's what the album comes down to, basically. It's having perspective on your life and on your art and on the different scenes and worlds and cultures that you exist inside of and peripheral to, and basically just having a healthy relationship with it all.
But it, like, it's still, like, fundamentally to me is an emo album, like, especially in the sense of, like, a song like The Shark's Own Private Fuck, which is, you know, I certainly, it sounds like there was a lot of bad blood between Mendel and either Enoch or just the rest of the band as a whole, but, like, it strikes me as a fundamentally childish response to Mendel's departure, which is so interesting contrasted with how much of the record is, like, looking back and responding to how immature the person writing the records used to be. That, and that's part of what makes the record so interesting to me, is that it doesn't settle on having fully grown, you know, certain, it certainly doesn't regress at all, but it, especially on the note that it ends on, is really fascinating in the sense of, like, it, this is a process.
Like in Every, you know, Shining just, Time You Arrive, the refrain is, I want to change everything. I want to blame everything on unfinished statement, right? It's that, that in that song, which is the most sort of ecstatic song about, like, finding, like, a purpose and, you know, a healthy way of living through your embrace of religion or whatever, is also still a song about, you know, part of the reason why this is so appealing to me is that it gives me a way out of my worst tendencies, or it gives me a way to kind of try and reject those worst tendencies, which still are a part of me.
Yeah, it's the hope in it is not that I have transcended these tendencies and life will be better from now on, but the hope is that someday these tendencies will, I will give into them less often than I do my better nature. And, like, what is more emo than that?
Yeah.
It's all about nuance. It's that, that's what it all is that I think it's interesting that, like, to me, it is kind of an album that is racked with a lot of anxiety, because that's what I think makes the musical denouement of the ending so satisfying, is that that's the moment where it feels like the album, it's just kind of lets everything breathe a little bit. But it's never, like, just that. To me, it's just, it's an album where everything is constantly in flux. Like, everything's constantly moving, everything's constantly, like, dealing with itself, and then you sort of come to the conclusion that that's always the way that it's going to be. Everything, you're not able to, like, put everything in a box. You're not going to be able to, like, do all of this. And, like, it, like Morgan said, that sort of the response of, you know, the, in The Shark's Own Private Fuck, that song is that sort of, it's an implicit tacit acknowledgement that that immaturity is going to still live with you. It's all a fucking, I mean, it's all a fucking circle. These things aren't things you can grow, you can change, you can move past these other things, but fundamentally all of these things are still a part of the human experience. Mm-hmm. And I feel like the listening to this album, you kind of experience the breadth of it all. And I kind of feel like the act of listening to it, both sonically and thematically, it feels like therapy. Like, it just, when I listen to this, it feels like the darker parts of myself are just kind of like, I'm getting them out. I'm looking at them and I know they're there, and I'm not, like, I'm not dispelling them. It's just like, I'm aware and I can just go forward. And that's that, it's a feeling of liberation. That's not wholly good or wholly bad. It's just sort of, again, it's there, it's nuanced. The actual sort of self-evident truths that are in it are things that are very, like, basic, but it's because you tend to overcomplicate those things with things like emo. You know, you make all of these emotions really big, and then you cloud your judgment, and then everything becomes super duper messy. And this is about finding clarity amidst the mess. And that's why listening to it feels so weirdly good for as much darkness as in it.
Shout out Jimmy World, who would find clarity in 1 year's time.
Bam. Oh, true. We have connected all the threads of emo together, and then we've made the anti-emo album that gave way to the emo album. Boom.
I was definitely being a little bit edgy when I called it anti-emo, but it's like anti-emo.
It's a good byline. I like it.
Anti-emo in the sense that it is emo, but it exists as a kind of commentary on emo to a certain extent.
What's more emo than that?
We've kind of peeled back the layers here, super, super deep. It's a fascinating album. And that kind of complexity and nuance to the philosophy of the record, I think, is kind of why it's one of those albums that can become a really big part of your life. I think I feel it becoming a really big part of my life and influencing, as well as being influenced by, the way that I view the world and the way that I view my life. So yeah, it's a really special album in that way. And it's proving to be, for me at 26, what Diary was for me at 16.
This is one of my favorite albums that I've listened to for the first time this year. This is a 10, a very strong 10 at that. This might even be like in the top five things I think I've listened to this
I thought
year.
You were gonna Jesus. Say this is such a strong 10. This might even be an 11.
You know, I mean, you know what? Sure, man. Might even.
Also a 10, also one of my favorite first listens of the year.
Holy fuck.
Talking about, it's a 10, baby. You got three 10s.
This has gotta be up there with the illustrious group of like five albums that have earned perfect marks from all three of us.
Hell yes. Let us know what you think of Sunday Real Estate and their third album in the comments below. What does this band mean to you? What does this album mean to you? What do you think of our conversation? Let us know your thoughts in the comments below. If you want to go above and beyond and support us directly for just $1 a month, you can hit the join button, become a member of the Jams D family, get your name in the title call of every video on the channel. Plus, if you want to recommend us some music to talk about in our Now episodes, your recommendation will go to the top of the pile. Until next time though, folks, rock over London, rock on Chicago, five gum, stimulate your senses.